That is a part of it. All right, next question. This will be a fun one. Bruce, I recently had a chance to see the – oh, this is from Jake Keith. I recently had a chance to see the 1983 Loser Leafs Town match between Jerry Lawler and Bill Dundee, and it stacked up against anything going today. Just tremendous. Dundee was a guy who could carry a match, cut a promo, and knew how to work a crowd, especially in studio matches. But you never hear much about him when people talk about great workers. Who do you think are some of the most underrated wrestlers throughout the years, guys that could really go out but never seem to get the mainstream praise?
You know, first, that match is a hell of a match. If you can track it down, it's one of those things where no one knows exactly who owns that footage and all that kind of stuff. But it's definitely out there, tape traders and all that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can see the TV, because it was Memphis Television where they showed everything or most everything that related to it, to the match, and it was Jerry Lawler and Bill Dundee, Loser Leave Town. And sure enough, Jerry Lawler left town, and it's the one I'm thinking of. There's another one where Bill Dundee leaves town. No, that I'm trying to think of which one it is. So, Jay Keats, I'm sorry that blew a gasket on this, but I mean, both of them are tremendous. But the store, but there's a long piece of television. It's the quintessential Memphis thing. I mean, it's Jerry Lawler is absolute greatest, and promos and telling the story. And I actually saw, back in the early 90s, got to talk to Lance Russell about it. And he was just, he kind of said that those
The Memphis announcer, I mean, I hate to insult the people who know that. But
Memphis announcer who announced all this and who was really good and really well-respected and, like, fit like a glove Memphis wrestling. And knew both of them, and just said that they both wanted to outshine the other one because, and you know, Bill Dundee is a cliche to say it, but he had the small man's complex where he, and it fit in his character in wrestling where he was this short, banty guy who was willing to fight anybody, and that was his character, and that was the way he was in real life, and he was jealous of Lawler. Lawler was the king of Memphis, and that was what was on television, and they would team together, and then they would have a break, and they would have a breakup. And then they would fight like crazy, but of the Memphis style, the punch and kick Memphis style, just great punches thrown and a ton of drama. And they put up, if this is the one where he put up his, Bill Dundee put up his wife's hand and Loser Leave Town, and it just, they show it on television and the guy leaves, but it's like this, just, and it's one of those things, if you watch nostalgia stuff, a lot of it, you watch it for nostalgia reasons, and there's little parts that you can pick up and go, this little part here might work in wrestling today, or this little part here.
Yeah.
And the promos are better. The promos are more immediate and don't have that sameness about them that today's promos have. But the other stuff, not there, but I swear if you put that match on television, if those guys could somehow be in 2008 at that point in their life, in that shape, and you put it on TV, and you put those issues together, it would do great now, and that's a real rare thing, and it's a tremendous deal. And Bill Dundee, though, to me, he's on the other hand, though, Bill Dundee by himself wouldn't work today, and I don't think he would have worked when he went other places. He wasn't anywhere near as effective. He was an Australian guy. He was very short, but but he could talk. He could talk in this real cocky way, and he could wrestle, and because he built up credibility every week on Memphis television for, I don't know, 1975 to 1980-something, to 1989, and those people saw him, they believed that he could fight, and they believed in him, they believed him as an act. And so he could be at the top of the card, but then when you put him in the middle of, they brought him to Jim Crockett Promotions, you put him in the middle of the show in Jim Crockett Promotions and didn't give him that time to talk and that time to beat bigger guys and to be involved with the biggest name in the company like he was with Jerry Lawler, then it just wasn't that good. And if he went to Kansas City or went to wherever else he went, so he stayed in Memphis. That was where his bread and butter was, and he fit that time and he fit that era. Now, a guy that just, at his size, that punched and kicked and wrestled that style wouldn't work today, but that whole match would have worked today because it really has. It's just really something fun to see. And Lawler's just so good. Good grief. both in the ring and out of the ring. I mean, it's just really played well, and great announcing for it. It holds up. Other guys, I mean, guys are specific to their time. I'm trying to think of guys that I thought would have gone somewhere and done more. You know, I think it's weird. It was one of the biggest territories. But I think, like, you think of people who, you know, the territory days, the people that didn't go to New York and what would have happened if they'd gone to New York. If Nick Bockwinkle had gone to WWF in New York and maybe not been the champion, but challenged, say, Bruno San Martino, or challenged Bob Backlund in the way that he talked and the way that he was, I think that would have been really interesting and really good. Terry Funk kind of moving to New York in the territory days, not when the national promotion would have been pretty cool and pretty interesting. But, I mean, he's really well-respected. You know, Bockwinkle to me, I mean, he went to Texas and he was in the big promotion, but he wasn't seen on a nationwide basis until he was kind of down a little bit. And so that would have been, that's a hard question. I don't know, that's a hard question to answer.
Like, it is a hard question.
You know, because a lot of the guys, there were guys that were talented, there was like the Buddy Landells of the world, there were guys that were talented that couldn't hold it together in other parts of their lives and they never got to go through. And in the last 20 years, if you were good, you made it to the national promotions, you got seen a ton.
Yeah.
Unless, like I said, there was something about your life that you couldn't keep professional or you got hurt where you couldn't do it. But if you could hold it together, for instance, the national expansion of wrestling and the national companies has definitely been there. Let me think. Who was really, you know, that big a thing? I don't know. You know, there were the guys that went to Japan who, you know, Dr. Steve Williams and the Terry Gordy's who went away and then the national scene didn't see them, but they were doing stuff that you could see. They were doing great stuff and having great matches and Stan Hansen too and those kind of guys. But they were in Japan. So, you know, I don't know. I don't think I answered that question very well. I don't know who would be out there. But if you're a tape collector, that's a hell of a deal to get. That Memphis stuff in that era is just and particularly the ins and outs of Jerry Lawler and Bill Dundee. And
yeah.
There was like one match they just showed 60 minutes. They showed the whole match. And it was just, you know, the crowd's going crazy and you don't know who's going to win and there's a bunch of consequences. And Lawler's punches are perfect and the kicks are perfect. And Lawler gets down and hurts his eye and Dundee's on him and it's a hell of a deal.
Yeah.
Two or three matches like that. But I know the one, and I'm just blanking out on whether that was the one where Lawler lost it. But hopefully Keith will put it up on the site where Lawler lost. And I know that Conga Day Wills is wanting to kill me, but that's what I'm remembering right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, yeah.
But there are definitely people that I think that's one of those ones where it's not just the nostalgia that would carry it, that somebody, if you're watching it, you weren't around for that stuff, and that's not the era of wrestling you grew up. I understand when people go, you know, look at something and just go, this is old and boring and slow. It's like, yeah, it is. It's just, you know, a lot of it is, but it fit its time, and somebody will look back on the stuff we're watching now and go, it's kind of slow and stale.
Yeah.
And we'll do that in about, you know, 6 days. So.
All right, let's move to the next question. And this comes from Carolina for Life. And
what an awful name.
Yes. We talked a lot about Gabe Sapolsky last week. Part one of his question was evaluating Gabe Sapolsky's booking and where he ranks among all-time great bookers. Give me a short answer to that because I don't want to spend we gave a good amount of time to him last week.
He's not at the very top because to be at the very top, he would have needed the opportunity to book a promotion that had that had all the resources that the top promotions of his time had, and he didn't get that chance. So and then if he had that chance, then that he took that company and blew it up,
yeah,
and did major business with the company for a major stretch of time, and created and established new stars. I mean, created new stars and then made the best of them.
You can't take away from him that he didn't have the resources in that setting for his booking to blossom, but you also can't give him credit without seeing it happen.
Right. So that very top echelon of great bookers, who did that for their time, I don't put them in that. I put him in whatever the level is right below that.
Yeah.
Because on the other hand, he had more challenges than most bookers and really made something of it for a number of years. The fact that they survived with all the things that were against them that we talked about last week and were able to get it to a level that they would get their business to a level, as flawed as their business is, that in comparison to the people that had the same resources.
And let's put it this way. I'd be surprised and saddened if we've seen the last of him as a booker.
You know, I don't know. I would be saddened, but I don't know. I think we didn't talk about this, but I think we are in this era, and I don't want to go on and on about this, but I think we're in this era that being successful outside of the two national companies and having a real track record works against you.
What'd you think of Paul? Did you read Paul Heyman's blog this week at the UK Sun?
You know, I usually do, but what was
the he just at the end? He just said, and he wrote about WWE and some of the problems with the 3-hour show on Monday, and actually echoed some of our thoughts in our update from yesterday.
No, actually, I hadn't seen that.
We echoed him.
I had quite the week, so.
That's okay. And then at the end of it, he just said, and if they don't do this, I might have to come back. And then he said, just kidding. And it's, you know, it just ties into what you're saying about Gabe and Heyman. It's like, you wonder at some point if there's a really good, inspired, motivated booking mind out there for wrestling, especially one who has a chance to recharge, a Heyman, a Cornette, or a Sapolsky. It's just hard to imagine that those three in particular haven't had a chance to become head bookers or won't have a chance to be head bookers in the future of something, whether it means Shane and Steph get together and say, yeah, let's give this a try in 4 years from now when the world's different, or, you know, Dixie Carter and Jeff Jarrett have a falling out and Vince Russo is kicked out the door and they go, well, who do we go with? And Mike Tenay and a couple other people say, oh, this guy's worth a chance. I mean, it just seems like it's almost inevitable that you would think they would get an opportunity, yet you're right when you say the odds aren't as great as they should be, and they may not even be better than 50%.
Because they threaten the people that have the jobs.
Yeah.
That idea that someone from outside of this that might possibly know more, that can't be true, because now it's part of the fabric of what they do, that the only way you can do this is to be in here and do it our way. And the only way to do it is our way. And it's not only Gabe Sapolsky, but in a bigger picture. And it's been for I don't know how many years, but I point more at WWE. The WWE has had the chance to take in people that resources they really could use that they deliberately don't want. They deliberately don't want a lot of people from a background that could be grown into something that's a real booker, and that's the learning the business from outside and knowing the business in so many different ways and wanting that. We don't want you, that's poison, that you're stained with that.
Right.
And that I've heard people, I think of somebody specifically, an announcer candidate that I knew of that had to hide that he was a lifetime fan. And, you know, went up and didn't get to the top level of the, didn't get the job, but definitely got far enough along the ride and was good enough to be a final candidate, one of the final candidates for a job, but also had to like be very careful what he said and what he did because they would look askance at that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and there's that thing of let's get in these young Hollywood types at the bottom of the ladder who will work for us and not pay them and then burn them out and get a new crew in and burn them out instead of kind of building for the future of what's
happening. And it's all Vince Russo and Ed Ferrara's fault because they left Vince high and dry. You know, he trusted them with a lot of power. And when they left, I think there was a feeling, and Stephanie was just kind of coming of age at that point, and they kind of collectively said, you know what, we're not going to give anybody who's not part of the family that kind of power ever again.
Yeah, we're not going to grow somebody from that thing. And I think that there are people that might have been really good bookers for national companies that never even got started because there's no way to grow into it. There's nothing more with it. And there's that thing of all those writers, how many of those writers who've been through the company who have said, I'd never go back, I'd never do anything like that. And then that stuff is strangled off. And then there's just the cronyism of Jeff Jarrett surrounding himself with trying to surround himself with people who can get him over and not threaten him at the same time. And that's that led to it too. So or the cronyism of if they booked in the 1990s, then they know something because that's when I was most excited to be in a wrestling booth.
Right.
And that kind of thinking. And that,
well, let's go to part two of that question because it relates. And it's a good, honest question. During WCW's most successful run, that being the NWO era, who was their head booker? It seems like I only hear about Jim Herd, Bill Watts, Dusty Rhodes, Kevin Sullivan, and Vince Russo screwing up the product at various times, but never heard anyone give credit to whoever it was in charge of creative during the NWO era. Was it one of these men? Although I'm pretty sure it wasn't Herd or Watts. How involved creatively was Eric Bischoff with the success of that angle? Very, very good question.
Yeah.